Hi, this is John Udell. For this week's podcast, I got together with Paul Patrick. He's the architect of BEA's AquaLogic product line. Although we think of BEA as being very Java-oriented, about a year ago, the company announced its intention to broaden the focus of its service-oriented infrastructure. In today's interview, we talk about what's happened over the last year and where things are headed. First of all, thanks for making time on short notice to do this.
I'm happy to do so, John.
I guess it's been about a year since the headline, BEA announces intention to become Switzerland of SOAs.
Uh-huh.
It's probably a good time to reflect on what's happened in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
I also have, and we can do these things in any order, but I did want to ask you to kind of reflect on the Corba experience.
Sure.
It's occurred to me that as much as we used to talk about the impedance mismatch between code and databases, we have a kind of an impedance mismatch nowadays going on between objects and services.
Mm.
The Corba approach or the DCOM approach was object-centric with the notion of hammering out wire protocols that would, in a sense, support object-oriented calling conventions. And now we're all much more interested in declarative service contracts and things
right.
like that. But the fact of the matter is that as declarative as we want things to be and are trying to make them, there is still a tremendous amount of object-oriented programming that goes on inside of our systems.
Yep.
And a tremendous amount of componentry that is oriented to that paradigm rather than to the service paradigm. There is then balkanization in terms of the dominant object-oriented runtimes, and so there's a large set of componentry that's evolving around the .NET runtime. There has been and continues to evolve a large set of componentry evolved around the Java runtime, and those are different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, we have XML messaging as an interchange at the sort of service layer. And, you know, we're now, to our credit, thinking a lot about how to compose applications at that relatively coarse granularity. But what's your thinking about, you know, kind of going back to the Corba world in terms of the way in which we still are doing an awful lot of object-oriented programming, and the environments in which we do that are, you know, still fundamentally kind of non-interoperable in important ways, aren't they?
First off, I think some of the predecessors to web services kind of got a bit of a hard rap about being so object-centric. I think, I know of a couple scenarios out there of very, very large Corba installations who actually did SOA. And I think
mm-hmm.
what's at the heart of that really is choosing the granularity of the entity that you were attempting to make the exposed face.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think when we think about this, we have people continuing to, with WSDL and things like web services, expose fine-grained objects.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using web services the exact same way they did Corba and DCOM and other technologies. I think what's different here, four or five large companies, and I won't say it was predominantly across the industry anywhere like it is today with web services, actually figured out it wasn't about the wire protocol. It's about at what level of an interface did you expose a service today or an object back then. And the second one was, what kind of object did you expose? And I think these were people that tended to be looking more business-focused, a la using technology for the purposes of the business, rather than the classic approach, which I think the predominant, the industry in general utilized back in the Corba days, which was, if you will, remote C++ type modeling,
mm-hmm.
where you did language-based models and then you expose them across the distributed communication technology, and Corba being the most popular at the time.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who actually thought about it from how business works, the classic example that always strikes me is banking, where, for example, what many of the successful people did was they realized that when you walk into a bank, you don't actually walk in and touch your account. It's a mediation kind of scenario, and so they modeled their business after the way real business worked, and that was the idea of tellers and things like that. And that was the object that they exposed rather than the account.
Mm-hmm.
So they worked very, very well as a Corba object, and they said, well, this intermediary or this entity does something on your behalf. And they have been people, and I can think of one particular institution, who've actually gone through four different technology transitions, yet the architectures remain the same because of what they did.
Because they did a good job of establishing service boundaries.
Exactly. And so that was kind of driven more by the business than from the bottom-up type scenario.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that struck me, if I compare and contrast the state of the world to the state of the world back then, was the idea that back then it was almost like the approach that we took to everything was, first you have to have a programming paradigm, and then you worried about distribution. Then there was more than one of you, and so then you worried about interop, and then you had security and transactions and, you know, things tailored off from there.
And oh yeah, operations.
Yeah, that's right. Oh yeah, operations, exactly. And as I look at it today, the kind of approach or what I've seen that's occurred in the web services world and the solar world is, we first worried about interoperability and how we were going to represent things as the first order problem.
Mm-hmm.
And to this date, we really don't have a standardized unified programming model, and it's not clear that we really want one yet.
Right.
It's caused us to have to think about interoperability and security as first order problems rather than second or third order problems.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be probably one of the biggest things that contribute to the success of SOA this time around.
So here's an interesting question then, is it has historically been true that we've made this distinction between coarse-grained business objects,
mm-hmm,
and more fine-grained, I don't know what you want to call them, IT objects,
yep,
on the basis of practical efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why wouldn't we want to have all of that flexibility and separation of concerns in our IT infrastructure at a lower level?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we would want to, but it's just not going to be efficient. You know, so
right,
of course, for a certain layer of infrastructure, you know, we're going to go Java, we're going to go .NET, we're going to go in process,
mm-hmm,
to the extent that we can, because we're driven there,
right,
in terms of efficiency. Well, times change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not there yet, but at least from my perspective, I'd say that it's quite likely that boundary is going to be driven down.
Absolutely.
Into lower and lower levels of infrastructure, so that, you know, all of this SOA goodness, you know, should start to apply at lower levels of,
right,
of our stuff, which goes directly to this question about componentry, right?
Yeah.
You know, and how we're still sort of, in terms of our internal components, we're still kind of locked into these, like you said, programming model first sorts of ways of thinking.
Yeah, I think it's a great point, John. I think one of the things that's occurred is, for numbers of reasons, you know, shrinking IT budgets and having to do more with less, thinking about how to do things in a more business type standpoint, how do we expose ourselves with concepts like offshoring and B2B and things like that, which have always kind of been there but really are in the forefront now more than ever. We've had to think about, you know, how can we, if we're down at a programming model level and we're trying to expose this to our partners, unless we're some, you know, huge company, a Walmart or something like that, we're not in a position, most of us aren't in a position to tell our partners, you'll do it like this.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be more of this open, collaborative type scenario. And so focusing on the business makes sense. But I think what a lot of people tend to overlook is, SOA is not a technology. It's an architectural approach,
mm-hmm,
which is really at the heart of the question. And so, I mean, the reality here is, and I'll go back and give Microsoft some credit here with COM. Most of the original COM objects weren't fine-grained kind of programming objects. You had classes that tended to represent closer to business entities, and you had interfaces that were exposed to manipulate them, and the interfaces were higher level. The idea being is, there's nothing in the SOA architectural approach which requires a wire.
Mm-hmm.
And so a term that I've been using about how do you think about how do I build services in such a way that I'm not first focusing on the wire per se, but I'm thinking about exposing the business in this more coarser grain type scenario, is a term I call service-based. The idea is, I start thinking about how I would build my code or refactor my existing stuff, which may be very object-centric, into more service-based approaches. And then I think about things like, how do then I expose these services to the outside world, where web services, async messaging, eventing, all are exposure schemes. They're not the programming paradigm, if you will,
mm-hmm,
day one.
Mm-hmm.
So we think about kind of this, to get to your question, about really how do we take this concept, this SOA architecture type approach of more coarse-grained things, and start driving that downward, because the point here really in the SOAS stuff isn't to do web services. The point really is, how do I make myself more agile? How can I reuse assets that I already have in a more efficient fashion to achieve business goals?
Mm-hmm.
And if I componentize, I abstract, and follow the classic kind of SOA paradigm, regardless of which exposure technology I'm going to use, I should be able to drive that lower. And I think that will allow us, because the reality is we don't have the funds nor the desire in many cases to go back and rewrite systems from scratch, who were heavily, you know, object-focused. It gives us the means as part of the refactoring to, through a level of abstraction and through aggregation, pull those fine-grain objects together into more of a service approach and then choose an appropriate exposure scheme.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there will never be any more fine-grain objects, I don't think makes any sense. The reality is there's some extreme value in the concepts that are imposed and out there through these object-oriented programming languages. But it's really about how we model things, how we go about exposing things. That's at the forefront of what we need to think about, not which programming language it's in.
Mm-hmm. It does present two different strategies for operations and system management, though, doesn't it? I mean, we have a whole style of doing things in the object world,
right,
based on the kinds of runtimes and the operational characteristics of those.
Yeah.
Very different situation in the world of service management, right, where we're much more used to the idea that everything's externalized into sort of a neutral messaging environment, you know, where we expect to be able to insert intermediaries and monitor and control things and assert policies,
right,
and have business rules and have a bunch of stuff which is architecturally outside of,
right, mm-hmm,
applications. You know, it's the application network rather than,
yep,
the application. It's a really different model.
Right. I think we're as we look at business, as I go out and I talk to customers and people in the industry, and we look at business, you know, and I hear them talk about agility, and I hear them talking about, you know, being able to run their business at a more, breakneck speed than before. All of a sudden, I start hearing things come up about availability and resilience and things like that, and they almost always compare it to the internet now,
mm-hmm,
rather than compare it to, well, back in DCE or back in Corba we did.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about the internet and we look at the resiliency in the internet type scenario, you begin to realize late binding is in fact a very key thing, but something that most of us have not necessarily looked at very closely right now. And I think we're going to find ourselves in a situation where we're going to want the failover, we're going to want the reliability, we're going to want the resilience, if you will, in these systems. And so therefore we know we're going to bring up new capacity or add new services, or services are going to go down and get relocated in that. And we're going to have to put that kind of dynamic capability into the system. And some of that you see people starting to do with things like the idea of using intermediaries, and I think the most popular one in this scenario is enterprise service buses.
Mm-hmm.
As a means to kind of, if you will, build that line of abstraction between the consumer and the rest of the back. But at some point, we're going to get these buses to the point where the buses now need to know where the things are and what happens when they move. We can't continually go back to a classic approach that we've seen done in some distributed systems where we create basically storms of messages to keep the bus in sync. And so we've got to start thinking about new approaches, approaches that we're seeing every day in things like presence technology.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so maybe, you know, things like UDDI or something along those lines starts to morph into more of where is the service and get me there. And I think that's going to drive us into a new wave. And that wave is going to be the idea that somehow we're going to have this idea that services are basically floating in the network, and the network's going to help me find the best path to get there. And that buses and intermediaries and that are going to drive us into a direction where they're going to need to know more about the service than just where it's at, but is it up, is it down, is it meeting its SLAs, and they're going to get more intelligent.
So it is an ambition of yours to create something that I've been calling the service delivery network as opposed to the content delivery network.
You know, it's certainly something I'm thinking about, but quite frankly, I think customers are beginning to come to that realization.
Oh yeah,
we're hearing a lot more about the need for federation, And when we talk about federation, a lot of it has to do with resiliency and partitioning and dealing with organizational boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this idea of having service delivery or service delivery fabric is very much a growing need.
So let's talk a little bit about that then, because I well remember a couple of years ago when Akamai started talking about edge services.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they had, maybe still have, although I don't really hear much about it these days, a product called Edge Services for Java. Then there was going to be one for .NET.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of didn't take off. And then just recently, it's fascinating to watch what people are making out of that Rorschach blot called Amazon S3. It's a different thing to everyone, depending on what they need to get out of it. But
right.
One of the things that is clear that people want to get out of it is not just, you know, a managed content delivery network, but in fact, people are trying to morph it into a service delivery network, which is totally not what it's designed to do. But the fact that that's where people are trying to take it tells
right.
you something extremely interesting. You know, if that's in fact where you'd like to take Aqualogic or part of where you'd like to take it, then there are some interesting practical considerations there. You know, I mean, right now, if you look at your product line, there's a bunch of Java stuff, right? And there's a bunch of web services stuff, and you know, nothing specifically .NET
right.
yet there, you know, and nothing specifically in the, I guess you could say, the LAMP or REST or, you know,
yep.
lightweight XML over HTTP area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those are all substrates on which people are kind of groping towards this service delivery network idea.
Yep.
What can you do, or what would you like to do to materialize that concept on those various substrates?
We're driven very much by what our customers need to do. And it's very clear in talking to them that this idea of breaking out, that looking at this problem very differently than the classic messaging problem that a number of people have tried to do,
yeah.
and thinking about this in more of a, and like I said, I keep drawing back to this network-like concept, is driving us in those kind of directions. And
mm-hmm.
And what that means is that, you know, we have to broaden our horizons. We have to think more about not just web services, but plain old XML,
mm-hmm.
the POX, and dealing with REST and things like that.
But I mean, what does that mean in practice? I'll tell you what I'd like it to mean in practice
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, this actually takes me all the way back to, well, you were a DEC guy, right? Back in the early
14 years.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't think I met you then, but when I was at Byte Magazine, I met some folks from some part of the Corba team. I forget exactly what the name of that division or
could have been ACA Services or
it might have been. You know, these guys had this just completely agnostic approach. You know, it's like,
yep.
you know, we'll wrap it. I mean, we don't care what it is. It's a shell script. It's a Windows application, right? It's a batch file, right?
Yes, ACA Services.
Was that it, ACA Services?
Yes, I was the architect there.
You were? Okay, great. So, you know, that's the thing that I can see pretty clearly is both possible and desirable, which is to say, you know, you wind the clock forward 15 or 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and I've got this thing, and, like, it doesn't matter what the thing is made out of, right?
Right.
You know, what I want is I want the effect of, I want to be able to drop it into this service delivery network. I want
right.
to know that it will be managed, it will be replicated, it will migrate to the point of use, it will be monitored and controlled
yep.
in the ways that I need to be. And
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And in fact, a lot of the vision that I have for where I think this idea of services in a network goes is based on my experiences working in that group. The idea
mm-hmm.
that And when I think about what we're building in Aqualogic, you know, our service bus doesn't just speak web services.
Right.
It speaks JMS. It has pluggable transports, which means that I can do things like file. I could build a custom transport and allow it to wrap scripting and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That same kind of, I mean, at the time when we were building ACA services, which morphed into a Corba product in the name of Object Broker,
mm-hmm.
they were all services. They
mm-hmm.
just didn't have a standard that they were all wrapped around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had to incorporate these various kind of assets that were live and real in an enterprise, and they were all used to help get the business done. And
yes.
so being able to tie all these various and disparate type of things together into a common approach was really at the forefront. And that's kind of when I think about SOA. I don't relate SOA to web services. It's just one of those transports and exposure schemes in my bag of tricks.
Right. And for a lot of people right now, it is the ante, right? It's the price
mm-hmm.
of entry.
Absolutely.
If you want to get into one of these service fabrics that is going to deliver you all of this distribution and management capability, then it's pretty much incumbent on you to step up to the plate and comply with a growing number of web services standards. You know, alternatively, though, there are lots of other ways of doing things that are popular.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually kind of interested in, you know, specifically and from a practical perspective, you know, what can you support? What would you like to be able to support?
In thinking about the services, and that's why BA's been pretty vocal about the idea that SOA not equal web services,
mm-hmm.
right? You're right. Yeah, I think the way you phrase it is correct. Web services is the ante to the table. If I think back to my ACA days, we had, as an engineering product, had to go build special environments for every one of the little operating systems and had to put special footprints for every one of the programming paradigms, whether it be the Microsoft paradigm or the Unix paradigm, whatever it was. I think what's different here is I don't have to build each and every one of the little paradigms anymore.
If people step up to the plate, you don't.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, an awful lot of people haven't.
Exactly.
Right?
So you know, that's where web services gives me something I didn't have. Now, at the same time, services are going to come in all shapes and sizes. We're seeing asynchronous services over messaging systems like
mm-hmm.
JMS has become a very popular scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But we're seeing a growth in services, server-side services being written in scripting languages.
Exactly.
Right? And so, you know, what I see us doing is reaching out and saying, if a service is in a hosted environment, we reach out to the hosted environment. And that means that we'll have to, you know, expand the kind of protocol translations we do, expand the kind of environments we can reach and tie into, so that we can continue to reach outward and expand that. Because I'm convinced that it's going to remain a very heterogeneous world. You know, REST is, you know, one week REST is hot, the next week it's cold, but it seems everyone feels fairly comfortable with POX.
Mm-hmm.
So, but POX isn't quite structured enough to do certain things. So
mm-hmm.
we're having to look at how can we make the ability for one to use those technologies simple and straightforward and tied into our infrastructure without saying that you've got to replace any infrastructure you get from us again from scratch.
Right. So what are the concrete steps that have been taken or are being taken along those lines?
For example, one of the things we realized is that there are a number of service environments that we didn't support out of the box, for example, in our service bus.
Yeah.
Or there are a number of environments, particularly in the Microsoft world, that were too cumbersome for information workers to get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You know, so try to tell someone who writes Excel macros that, you know, you need to write a web service client so you can get data out of the data service that gets exposed. It's pretty heavy-handed.
Yep.
On the other hand, they all know ADO.
Yep.
So, for example, in the case of that one, we added native ADO support, ADO.NET support, to our data service platform so
okay.
that the Microsoft macro writers can go off and just use ADO like they always have.
Okay.
And not have to figure out how to write a web service to do this. In the transport case, you know, I think the problem there is we can pick three or four, and there will always be the homegrown stuff that someone's built.
Yeah.
Right, and POX is for the most part homegrown in most places, but it's one that's prominent. So there we said, you know, we can't just say, well, we support transports X, Y, and Z in and out of the bus. We got to make the bus extensible so that you can plug in your own custom transport.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we can even move faster because now we can build transports for new hosting environments. So, for example, server-side PHP might be one that we might do, which might say, oh, okay, we can now reach out to that environment, encapsulate that, and bring that in and make that part of a standard offering
mm-hmm.
without having to wait for next major release of bus to roll out the door.
Mm-hmm.
So we've actually said we've got to apply SOA, and have been doing this, to the way that we build product because we need to make our products evolve faster to meet the customer needs.
Do you think that Indigo is going to be an important tool giving you leverage in the Microsoft world?
You can't ignore Indigo.
Well, why would you? I mean, why wouldn't you just use it?
You wouldn't want to. It's real. It's there. I mean, I can roll back the clock 3 years and recall many a conversation where .NET's a joke and ain't going to happen. That's not true. It's real. And so we have to play well in that environment.
Well, beyond play well in that environment, I mean, it strikes me that Indigo is a toolkit that you could use to great effect.
Hosting on a Microsoft platform, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's part of when we think about integrating, you know, integration goes through a series of phases. One might call it the arm's length or the protocol type scenario. And then you get into the hosting kind of scenario. Where can we leverage what's into the platform itself? And I'm quite confident you'll see us do exactly those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So on the data front, First of all, I've personally been a big fan of XQuery, which you guys were onto very early, I guess, originally with Liquid Data, right?
Right.
And then there's the sort of general question of the evolution from, if you will, sort of process-oriented security to data security.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, from my perspective, the power of XQuery in the context of a service-oriented architecture is it's based on the presumption that we have these increasingly richer exchanges of XML messages, you know, which are really the basis of communication.
Right.
And of integration, and that therefore intermediaries with a really strong ability to speak XML are just in a privileged position.
One of the things that we realized with these payloads in XML and the richness that's in it, that, you know, when I start thinking about, for example, in, you know, in data services platform, it's pretty obvious how you would use XQuery to make a query. But I start applying that to things in the intermediary, for example, in a service bus.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is I can find out information in a fairly quick and easy fashion by using XQuery over the message. And I then can use that information in new and different ways. For example, I can now do routing of messages based on not only content or you know, things in the header, but actually content in the message body itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I can take advantage of that. So that means that my routing immediately moves from an itinerary-based scheme to a content-based scheme. And then if I marry that with other information that I have, potentially even a context-based scheme,
mm-hmm.
my intelligence and my ability to route based on business now becomes much richer. And we're seeing our customers taking significant advantage of some of that kind of capability.
Yeah, I've heard some interesting examples of that, and I always like to kind of nail these things down and make them concrete. So I wonder if you have any stories to relate. It's always interesting to kind of nail it down.
For example, people are reaching into the body of the message because it's not necessarily in the header, retrieving information about, for example, an account for a given customer that's being manipulated as part of the payload, and being able to utilize that information to determine, for example, is the account in balance? Is there a shortfall here? Do we even want to start to bother to run the transaction because, well, there's insufficient funds, so we should go ahead and reroute the exception already?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, let's wait till we get to the business service and have the business service deal with pulling the information apart and then try and do the thing only to reject it, in which case we're using precious resources to deal with something that we could have caught earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Rerouting based on information, being able to pull things out and going, geez, you know, I know it's a gold customer, but the value of the request is really high.
Exactly.
Therefore, we want to give them a more of a platinum-type capability because we're talking about potentially some significant business here.
Yes.
That stuff that if you try and take, you know, classic kind of parsing and dealing with it, becomes very cumbersome to do. Since we're able to expose that in the creation of our pipelines to our customers, they can easily, in this declarative form, be able to describe to us what are these kind of conditions that they'd like us to take routing and the kind of actions they'd like us to do on those things.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it very powerful.
It also turns the security problem sort of inside out. It's really coming down to who's allowed to inspect and operate on that message that's flowing through the pipeline, who has access to the pipeline rather than who controls the endpoints.
Right. In looking at the problem in a broader sense and thinking about issues with government regulations, with things like SOX and things like that, we started looking at this problem a little differently than perhaps maybe some did. I mean, I know a lot of people are looking at the SOA and security and thinking about a perimeter-based approach. And perimeter-type enforcement, similar to what we had with firewalls and the web, isn't a bad thing, but it can't be the only thing.
Right.
One of the things that you start thinking about XQuery or any kind of query, and we start thinking about how most of the kind of businesses run over these services, they tend to be very query-intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that creates for a security person is this isn't like we're now doing, can you do the get account info? We're making queries.
Which are open-ended, yep.
And so what needs to be secured isn't just the ability to perform an action. It's the information being returned as a result of the action.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we ended up doing, for example, in our data services platform product is because of the richness of XQuery, because we have a declarative security system that's pluggable, we can actually do authorization at the element level of the return set.
Okay.
So we can literally redact, as the legal term goes, okay, information from the return set that the caller is unable or should not be permitted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, you know, we've all seen on television this so-called unclassified government document with all the black marks on it. We have a technique to do exactly that. So we can actually go down into the elements of the document and actually remove fields out of the document or deal with them so that you cannot, the consumer cannot see those fields and remove them.
So the idea here is the consumer has no access to the raw message traffic. What they have access to is a query capability.
Correct.
And they authenticate to the query capability and are then constrained in terms of what results can be shown.
Well, you can use their identity both in the constraints and in what they can, whether they can make the query, because that's still, we don't want to let services just be open to any old body.
Yeah.
You know, one of the age-old problems in security is if I can do a query, and even if I get told, you have no access to that account, I've already permitted too much information to be revealed.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to first control, can I do that kind of thing? And the second thing we have to control is when you get information back, what pieces of that information can you see? Maybe it's driven by privacy issues. Maybe it's driven by classification of information for one reason or another. But we have to change our thinking, because it is very much a retrieval of information kind of world that we won't know the results of until we perform the action.
In terms of the first kind of control, there is the possibility in theory of having parts of messages differentially encrypted to mm-hmm. different parties. In practice, as far as I can tell, that almost never happens. Is that your observation as well?
At this point, I would love if I could get most of our customers just to sign messages.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean,
right.
And by that, what I'm really worried about is really binding of information to identity correctly.
Yes.
Right? So that the tampering in that. What I've seen is most of the synchronous type communication is growing over the SSL link. It's not using, though, message signing and message encrypting capabilities that are actually been specified. One of the things that we started thinking about even more, when you start thinking about various interaction schemes to a service, you start thinking about asynchronous schemes, for example, and you want reliable delivery, so you want persistence. Well, putting things on a queue and the queue is persisted can create a covert channel.
Mm-hmm.
The covert channel could allow you to at least see information that you shouldn't see, even though it's sitting in the queue, or potentially allow you to manipulate it. And so we got to start. One of the problems is I think, you know, first, is this the year of PK again? We're going to hear that chant. and PK has been so difficult for anyone to do, so signing and sealing using public key infrastructure has been kind of put off year after year.
Mm-hmm.
I think the infrastructure that supports this is the folks that are going to be faced with how do we make this more secure for the user. That's where I think the declarativeness of things like WS security policy as a means of saying what do I require and what am I willing to accept and have the infrastructure enforce that instead mm-hmm. of turning around and saying, Mr. Developer, you need to encrypt this. We've got to shift that.
Yeah, well, that's been true forever, and the bottleneck remains what it always was, which is how can we possibly make that operation something that mom can understand, right?
Yeah, and I think that gets into how we begin to surface security.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that's been the rub all along of if we can surface the desire for confidentiality and let IT or the appropriate security people worry about, okay, our definition of confidentiality is implemented as such, I think we can make some significant headway in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, I think we're kind of we're either going to stay in the synchronous world for secure information because people just aren't picking up the other things and utilizing them at this point, or we won't be using async, and I think that could be, for many environments, that could be a very bad thing.
Yeah. There are some technologies here now that point in the right direction and just aren't really getting the kind of uptake that I think they deserve. And so the XML capabilities that have been built into Microsoft Office mm-hmm. for 3 years now, in principle, are a really important piece of the puzzle, because if you start getting people working in their applications, like the insurance form filling application,
right,
you know, such that it has some intelligence about what is the schema
right.
for this insurance application, and it actually understands what's what, then you have some semantic hooks to be able to apply security policies.
There's more to be done at the edge, more could be done at the edge than probably has been done and taken advantage of. I think the other one is the phenomena, or one of the phenomena that we hear talked about in Web 2.0, about information not just being locked up in the glass room in the center, but really information at the edge, especially with the explosion of mobility, has a really interesting impact upon how IT thinks about this, especially in the SOA world. Services aren't outward focusing. They have to be both inward focusing and outward focusing.
Gary McGraw over at Sigital, I interviewed him. He was actually my first interview in this series that I've been doing. And since then, he started his own. He does a security podcast. He's done, I think, three of them. The one I listened to just recently was with Dan Gere, and he referenced a study that was done, I think, by Hal Varian a couple of years ago about the sort of relative growth of things like, you know, processing power and storage and bandwidth. And it was basically storage is growing faster than processing power, and bandwidth is growing faster than storage. And so from his perspective, what that means is, you know, we've got a lot more data, and it's moving around all the time. And from a security perspective, it's like, oh my God.
right. And that is a challenge. I mean, but I think there's a natural marriage that begins to occur here. And we start thinking about today, people are concerned about laptops plugging into their corporate networks and making sure they're up to a particular level before they literally allow them on the network. I mean, it's no great leap from there to say, and all of a sudden when they join the network, there are services that provide access to that information on that laptop to the rest of the enterprise.
Yeah.
And that I find those. And I think, for example, that's one of the interesting drivers that kind of takes us to, well, if this is suddenly going to appear and it's not always in a known place at a known time, this is where the dynamic bind or the late bind type scenario starts to play out.
Of course, you should probably be just as concerned about what happens when that laptop leaves the network.
Exactly. Yeah, what happens to those local services?
Well, what happens to the data on the disk when it's, you know, the VA? Well, the service delivery network idea is something that I personally am feeling like I can't wait to see it happen. You know, what do you think we might be seeing in the next, you know, next little while that'll kind of take us down that path, you know, both from you and in general?
Yeah. Well, I think we're already beginning to see pieces of it. While it sounds so simple, geez, it's just like the internet, why can't we just grab that and go? The reality is there's a number of problems that need to get addressed. I think we're seeing some of that already as we're beginning to see people with starting to federate buses together, and the idea that really what's going on in the enterprise is that they're not building these big, massive messaging backbones. They're building, the analogy I used, I know Microsoft has used in Metropolis, and that has been this concept of neighborhoods and cities. And that these SOA projects tend to form around a neighborhood, and so there's basic, you know, how do I move around the neighborhood kind of stuff, and that's where kind of the buses are playing today. And then you start building out neighborhoods as you would any large city, and the next thing you find out is I need to put some control and I need to tie the various neighborhoods together to form the city. And that's kind of the point we're at, where federation is kind of the early roads into tying those cities together. And, for example, we'll be releasing a product, the new version of our service bus, that has, in fact, just exactly that, federated neighborhoods.
Do you think that there is an inherent advantage to the four or five entities on the planet who are operating these, what I call galactic clusters?
This concept of neighborhoods of services, we're actually finding happening in rather, you know, medium-sized companies. And the neighborhoods are being driven primarily by organizational boundaries, where they've got a divisionalized type company, or even more interesting, mergers and acquisitions. They acquire someone, they already have some form of SOA plan together, and you're back to stitching it together. I don't think we have to wait for the Uber global grid to happen yet for this to actually start to take hold,
right?
Because we're already seeing it begin
to
happen.
Opportunistic collaboration is going to happen definitely
from
the ground up.
And I think business will for quite some time remain a very systematic-like approach. But I think what they'll be looking at is how can I start building out? And the analogy, I sound like a broken record, I'm sure, is to go back to the network. is the way that we typically roll networking out, is we roll them out a segment at a time, and we tie the segments together, and then we have a new building someplace else on the campus, and it forms a new segment, and we wire it into the rest of the neighborhood, and things build out in a more organic kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing happening. And human nature being what it is, we don't want to give up control of information. Yet, we're in situations where we must share.
And we're also in situations where we would increasingly like to outsource the operational problem to someone else.
Exactly.
And that gets back to the hosting question, and how do I drop my service into someone else's managed infrastructure?
Yes. The idea, and I think in the government and the Department of Defense, it's the concept that is called communities of interest, where you have people like FEMA and Homeland Security, things like that, who come together on a short period of time, form a community which has got to tie lots of systems together, who at the time they were built had no clue that they were going to necessarily have to get tied mm-hmm. together, and then last for a period of time and then dissolve and go back to doing, if you will, their day-to-day kind of tasks in the other environments are mm-hmm. doing. Businesses are going to create partnerships in very much that same way. Partnerships are going to get created. Some of them are going to be very long-lasting, and so they may tend to look more like the classic B2B approach. But more and more of these are going to come together, formulate for a period of time, and then kind of disassemble themselves. I mean, we're seeing people already looking at using what, you know, one would think of as not content providers in the day, but certainly now the Googles, the Amazons, things like that, really as fulfillment arms suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Clearly, that's not running in their enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you recall, you mentioned a year ago, we made the big announcement. The reality was that back a year ago, we said syndication is the next wave. We recognized that what was going to happen is service-oriented architecture, if it really caught on, and then we had underlying standards-based interoperability capabilities, being web services and the like. The next logical step was, I can start outsourcing pieces of my business to be satisfied by others that are much better positioned to do that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So if my job is selling, you know, diaper genies and things like that, I'm probably not going to have a big warehouse if I can get somebody else to do that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that. We're seeing very early phases of that begin to happen already. Software as a service, I think, is going to somehow slide into that same kind of role.
Yeah, so then we've had kind of two approaches to that, right? There's the
yep.
sort of Grand Central approach, which says, I will provide the platform in the sky that
sure.
you guys come to and mm-hmm. and interoperate in the context of which, and
right.
but it's a kind of it's its own kind of walled garden, right? You know, and the other one
right.
is, well, we're just gonna, like you said before, opportunistically wire the stuff up peer to peer, right? And
yep.
you know, it's obviously not necessarily an either or kind of thing.
Yep.
But it is interesting to sort of speculate as to what the Grand Central on steroids of the near
yeah.
future might be.
If we think back to the days of, God forbid, VBXs, right? The idea of when we can actually have standardized services, we can have a cottage industry of building services that one can buy and incorporate. An ASP-type platform, a hosting kind of environment, makes sense for a number of companies
mm-hmm.
who could reduce their IT costs.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be others, though, who for competitive reasons have chosen that the competitive advantage of them being able to be more nimble in that by owning their own IT will choose to continue to run their own.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're looking at a world that, in the long run, will have a mix.
Yeah, well, I think that it will. And it actually has occurred to me that, although right now there is a tendency to sort of devalue in-house operational ability, that mm-hmm. as and when people start to get themselves onto these hosted platforms and become
yep.
dependent on them, and as then the price starts to ratchet up.
Yeah, well, I mean,
the pendulum swings back, right?
Sure. I mean, I think there's some opportunity. If we think about the early days of the web, where small to medium business moved very quickly because brick and mortars had such a hard time making the culture
yeah.
change, right? We have an opportunity that if we can establish some industry standards around protocols and definition of customer, things along those lines, the Grand Central kind of idea, there's some interesting things that can happen. Small to medium business can get a leg up and get moving faster,
yeah.
and then decide at what point in their business do they start, if you will, swinging the pendulum back
yeah.
into an internal.
Yeah.
Big business at the same time can begin to offload commodity kind of capabilities that they've been doing. For example, I mean, most large corporations that I've talked to used to do their own travel, now don't.
Mm-hmm.
right? And so I think what we're going to see is this oscillation, depending upon where your starting point is, between taking things out because we now have a means to do this and bringing things back in because we've grown in that and we were able to leverage the advantage that it gave us.
Yeah, that's a nice way to look at it.
Yep.
Well, then thanks. I've enjoyed this very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, John.
A pleasure to speak with you.
Yep, my pleasure as well. Thank you.